Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 32. Today we hear from Roy Sterman, software engineer with Mellanox, as he presents performance implications, libSCSI RDMA support from the 2016 Storage Developers Conference.
I'm Roy Sterman, storage engineer in Mellanox. Here with me is Sagi Greenberg. This project has been done in cooperation with my university. I just graduated, so with Ben-Gurion University, worth mentioning. So what I'm going to talk about in this project are common deployments of iSCSI initiator in virtual machine, from virtual machine, actually. I'm going to introduce libSCSI, which is a user space iSCSI library, which is available in QEMU and all other applications. I'm going to talk about ICER, which is an extension for iSCSI over RDMA, which we implemented in this project inside libSCSI, actually. We are going to show some performance results of our solution compared to different iSCSI solutions, iSCSI deployments from virtual machine, especially comparing user space implementations versus kernel and ICER transport versus TCP. We're also going to talk about some challenge we had in user space when trying to implement. My microphone is off, so maybe it is. Okay. So I think I can talk without it. Thank you. Yeah, I think maybe Sagish. So I'm also going to talk about some challenge we have.
I think we're not sure if it's that or not. 1-2, 1-2.
All right, can you stick around? Just...
Yep. This is loud as well.
Saying the missing part of this table was the ISO implementation inside your system that we actually chose to implement inside LibreScSI. What is LibreScSI? LibreScSI is an iSCSI initiator user space implementation. It gives high performance, non-blocking, performance API. It has true implementation, including true. Thank you. So, what are the ISO vendors that you want to do? Actually, ISO is using all the information I talked about, starting with RDNA, the zero copy, the single copy, the carbon reliability, the log, eliminates this PCPAP process for the merits that is tracked together with management. Because for those events, we need to get an IO.
You don't only.
Yes, I got them, okay? Show them in a few slides. So, here we can actually see an ISO and a leaf control. When on the left side, you can find here an ISO initiator, an ISO. Second flow is the write command flow, which is pretty the same like the read command flow, except in ICER write command, you can put data and inline data inside the command. Actually, you can send data which can cause lower latency than doing more iterations. So now, I will go back to the table we saw before. We actually had motivation to implement ICER in libSCSI because a big advantage RDMA stack has over the TCP, it can access directly to the hardware from user space, okay? It doesn't have the sockets API, which is handled by the kernel. It has direct access to the hardware resources, to the RDMA contexts. So what we actually tried to do was to get the libSCSI, which supported only by TCP transport, and to create a transport abstraction so we could integrate our ICER implementation inside of it without taking any effects of the existing libSCSI library and all the applications that are using it.
And minimal user experience.
Yeah, also we try to do it as transparent as possible to the users so it will not have to change. We'll see it in a few slides. So we created the user space networking API, which is bypassing the kernel, as I said. We separated the data and control plane in ICER for optimization. We are planning to add nice and easy integration in QEMU. I will talk about it later. It's already in progress. And we tried and got high performance for our implementation. In this slide, you can see the modification we did inside libSCSI to add the transport support, the transport abstraction of ICER or TCP handling. This is actually the transport API, which includes.
You should talk about the motivation of why, you know, ICER and TCP are different programming models.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So actually, TCP and ICER has different APIs that the control and data plane has a similar functions. Okay, it's the ISCSI flow. but somewhere along the road it should be separated into TCP implementation or into ICER implementation, because they have different semantics, and I have a slide about it. Here you can see we try to centralize the transport specific code. Okay, we try to create a transport layer that which that will have the API inside of it, so we could plug in ICER and easily as possible. Also, we are planning to add ICER support inside LibSCSI in QEMU. LibSCSI has support in QEMU as far as today, also in LibVirt, which is a virtualization library that can be used to manage virtual machines. We moved the polling logic of the, in case of the TCP, it's the socket polling logic, and in case of ICER, it's the RDMA context of completion queue polling logic, into the transport layer, because there is a big dip. It's pretty the same to pull a TCP socket or an RDMA completion queue. You get basically the same consequences. We also moved the I/O vectors into the transport layer because in the deprecated, it's not yet deprecated, but in the old API, you first added the packet data unit of the iSCSI layer, and only then you added the I/O vectors inside of it. ICER can't work like this because it needs to have the I/O vectors the minute you want to send the message, compared to TCP. So merging process is in progress, should be available in next few weeks, maybe a bit more.
Excuse me. I go to previous slides. So you mentioned about polling logic, right? So is it like the application has the flexibility to choose whether it wants to choose interrupt driven or polling logic, or is it
No, actually, the polling logic is coming from the QEMU asynchronous I/O block driver. So it independently in ICER or TCP. I just mentioned that we moved all the polling logic into our transport layer inside LibSCSI to avoid the code duplications and.
So basically, all the I/O threads are originated in QEMU. So basically, each I/O has QEMU has a set of I/O threads. For each I/O, one I/O thread is assigned to pull for it. So it's not interrupt driven. Never. It's never is interrupt driven at the moment. I know that there are patches to integrate libevents to also work in a interrupt mode, but it's not available. So it's not directly connected to either TCP or ICER implementation. It's just the way QEMU works.
So here you can see the LibSCSI configuration inside libvirt XML file. Okay, each virtual machine needs to have its own XML file. You can see here the additional attribute of ICER. Okay, all the other configurations doesn't involve any of the transport layer. Okay, it can be changed, but the changes are going to be like very small, okay? Nothing to add to the user configuration anyhow. So after we talked about the implementation and the motivation, let's go on to the experiments and results we have done. We actually performed our measurements over Mellanox ConnectX4 on both target and initiator. We use the common TGT, user space iSCSI target, okay, which is very commonly used and very convenient to use. We use RAM devices as our backing store and the target devices, so we can check only the network protocol and not the problems that are in the target side. Our benchmarking tool was a flexible I/O, which is very also commonly used. Each guest we run, guest is actually the virtual machine, has a single CPU from QEMU, which is actually a virtual CPU, and single FIO job. A comparison has been done versus the three other options I mentioned before, Libby-SCSI TCP implementation, and the both kernel implementation, which is ICER and TCP implementation, but using the kernel modules and not the Libby-SCSI library. So this slide, you can see the both TCP bottleneck is probably not the NIC, okay? It's probably somewhere over the network stacks. You can see here the ICER attached device. ICER attached device is actually an ICER connection that we connected through the hypervisor and passed it to the virtual machine, as I mentioned before, as one of the common ways to.
So the VM is using VirtIO to talk to the hypervisor, which then uses ICER to.
Yeah, the connection is the VM is using VirtIO BLK. It doesn't even know that this is an ICER device. It gets the IO into the hypervisor, and then the hypervisor is using the ICER modules in kernel to execute the IO. As you can see here, this is the. Okay, I see there is a typo. This is the ICER Libby-SCSI, okay? This is not the ICER attached device. Yeah, I don't know why it says, you can see by the colors, that this is the ICER Libby-SCSI, which gets great performance from virtual machine, 180K IOPS
for
a single core. Yeah, you can probably understand that the core was fully utilized, okay? So. We'll see in a minute that you can aggregate more IOPS by using more cores or more VMs or whatever you want to use.
What was using CPU?
What?
You said you're saturating one core. What was using the CPU? You said this was an offload technology, right? CPU wasn't going to be involved with the transfer?
No. The offload technology is the RDMA offload, which is inside the hypervisor.
What was using
but
CPU?
Okay, the FIO application that runs in the virtual machine was
and using. There's still an IO stack. There's the QEMU IO stack.
Yeah, and the VirtIO stack. Yeah.
You need to post a work request. You need to check. You need to pull the completion queue.
No, actually, the poly.
The IP here on your chart was on the same adapter, the same machine.
Same setup as ICER, exactly.
All
actually,
the difference is software.
The
so I have a question here. So in between the time 6 to the time 9, the difference is calling the hypervisor?
Yeah.
And
there's the VirtIO overhead. The VirtIO from the guest into the host, that's the overhead.
Actually.
And also just another question. So the VirtIO on the. On the time 6 configuration, the ICER there is implemented by hypervisor user space or hypervisor
kernel, because you don't have an implementation of ICER in user space that is commonly used by, I don't know.
For example, run the Libby-SCSI in the hypervisor.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense to go into the hypervisor and again to go back to user space, you know, for.
Are you suggesting we are using Libby-SCSI inside the hypervisor, okay? When you are executing the IO in the VM, you're getting into QEMU, okay? And then QEMU actually can split it into two ways. With Libby-SCSI, it can operate the IO without accessing the kernel, without extra context switch. If you are using the ICER kernel module, so you need to go back to the kernel to handle the IO by the ICER modules.
Yeah, I'm just saying that clear comparison of puppets to others, you could theoretically also compare it to doing in the user space of the hypervisor, and then you will see the clear value of not going to the hypervisor. That's great.
And one more comment to Chuck. There is another aspect that consuming CPU, but we'll get to that once we talk about memory registration in user space, which is very challenging.
Follow-up question. what was the bottleneck in the TCP cases? Was that also CPU throttled, or was it something else like that?
It wasn't the CPU bottleneck. I'm not sure where was the bottleneck, but I'm guessing it's somewhere in the network stacks.
We could have probably tuned the TCP stack a bit more, I guess. But you know, we wouldn't have seen the same performance as RDMA just because you have all the overhead of TCP.
Processing the transport.
Yeah, but when we're speaking about TCP overhead, TCP overhead at the CPU level, right? It's not like the adapter is being sent away
to
the
vendor. Yeah.
So for addressing this question, I think that the right answer is that yes, it's the CPU.
Yeah, for this benchmark, Roy said it's not. It wasn't, but I guess it was the TCP stack wasn't perfectly tuned.
Yeah, but we got like 80, yeah.
And probably and the Noggle or other things that we could have tuned. Yes?
So, can you guys comment on the difference between the SIDSAX and MIMAX? What is the difference between?
So, the... What is the difference? Like the 9X is the Libby SCSI.
Yeah, what are the parameters that you use with 9X versus 6X?
The same parameters exactly, just the configuration is different. The 9X is the Libby SCSI user space implementation, and the 6X is the kernel ICER implementation. Okay.
Basically, there is VirtIO that the guest is talking to the hypervisor, and that's the difference. In the LibSCSI case, just there is a VirtIO protocol, but it's very light because it's right into the same context to actually go to ICER as well, through ICER. But PCI pass-through of block devices, you have the VirtIO protocol, which goes down to the hypervisor vhost, and then it's dispatching the command into the kernel ICER implementation.
Yeah, yeah. There is a typo here in the 181K. It's Libby SCSI ICER. You can see.
So in the Libby SCSI, both TCP test, did you run it with the TCP user space driver or TCP?
The Libby SCSI TCP is already in user space because Libby SCSI was written in user space.
So full stack in user space. Above TPDK, above what?
Above SOC.
It's not completely in user space because once you write into the socket,
you need to copy the data. Yeah.
Within the kernel.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, there are formal drivers in user space, and then you can eliminate also the context which stores the Linux.
Well, if you have a DPDK-based driver that uses poly mode and has a user space TCP/IP stack, well, you can get this probably some of the benefits, although not everything, because, well, for direct buffer assignments, it's hard for initiator mode because the NIC is getting raw datagrams from the wire. It doesn't know, like, in RDMA, what's the R key. There is no R key in raw Ethernet datagrams. So it's not an easy task, basically.
So we need to assume that the NIC context is towards the kernel on the device SCSI over the...
Yeah. When using the sockets API. Yeah, exactly. So... Next slide can show the bandwidth versus the different block sizes. We use this block size from 1K till 128K. IODEPT in this case was 64 to get good bandwidth. As you can see also here, TCP from both implementations is pretty much the same. Okay, you can see a little advantage to Libby SCSI TCP. You can see ICER attached device is 8 times better than TCP's implementation. And you can also here witness the ICER Libby SCSI, which gets 5.5 gigabytes per second, which is almost saturating the wire. Okay,
in case fabric
it's it was 56.
FDR.
Yeah, FDR. 56.
so you should mention that it's a single ICE connection. It's a single core to a single iSCSI connection to a single logical unit on the target side?
Yeah, it was mapped one-to-one from the initiator side to target. Here you can see the latency checks we did, also comparing the three other solutions. Also here you can see the ISO LibSCSI is getting an average of 60.43 microseconds per IO. We used 1K block size. We could use a lower block size, but we also checked it, and it was pretty much the same. And you can see on the when we took a higher IO depth, we got a linearization of the latency, but the slope is much better in ISO LibSCSI than in ICER attached device. Also here, the TCP has the disadvantage of the processing, like I talked before. Here you can see, again, latency versus block size, which you can also witness the benefits of both ICER, but you can see small advantage to LibSCSI ICER over the common use. I just want to talk about this one. This is a, we try to get an option of a scalability issue from different virtual machines to create multiple connections on LibSCSI ICER and the other solutions to see how it aggregates over the same host. And as we can see, a bigger slope is better scalability. We can see the ICER LibSCSI slope is getting good results and compared to the different ICER, where TCP is somewhere dashing somewhere near them. This is the IOPS of the same graph, and now I'll give Sagi to explain about the RDMA memory registration from user space issue.
Okay, so basically, you know, Roy enumerated all the benefits you get from RDMA, which is zero copy, you get CPU offload, which is, everything is great. But it doesn't come necessarily for free. In terms of really the application aspect and how you program your application, basically it means that now the device or the RNIC needs to know every address that you're gonna, of every buffer that you're gonna do networking from now on. And this buffer should also needs to be pinned into memory. It cannot be swapped out during the once it's pulled to other RDMA. It cannot be migrated to another NeMo socket. Basically, it's pinned wherever it is, it will stay there. So it's rather limiting, but it's still workable. So basically, pinning and also providing the RNICs, all the mappings of your networking buffers, is called memory registration in RDMA. And because it's a slow operation, okay? From user space, basically registering memory, it's a slow operation. You can use it in a data path. If you want to get good results, you can use it in the data path. And also, if you want to do it correctly, you pre-register up front all your buffers. If you want a remote peer to access your buffers, you need to pass it with the remote access permissions.
Okay.
So if you attended the last talk I gave as part of the NVMe with hybrids, I referred to fast memory registration. That's available in privileged user mode or in the kernel mode that is aware of the physical mappings. So for a user space application, you're not aware of the physical translation of your buffers. So you don't have the option to do fast memory registration. Okay?
Do you recommend FRMR?
Yeah, we can't use, we don't have FRMR in user space. There were attempts in the past to implement FRMR or expose FRMR interface from the kernel to user space, but they never really succeeded. But basically what we have is what we're stuck with. So applications usually needs to pre-register all their networking buffers upfront and then use those buffers to do RDMA transfer or data transfers. The problem is with mid-layers. So mid-layers like OpenMPI and SMEM in the HPC use cases or our Levi Scuzzy ICER implementation is that we don't own the buffers. The guest VM basically does an IO operation to its own buffer, and then we as a mid-layer see that buffer, and we don't know, basically it's not registered, and we need now to perform registration. So basically for each data transfer to do a member registration, which is a small operation, we wouldn't have been able to get high IOPS. So what do mid-layers usually do? Or what are the options for them to solve? One of them is pre-registration of the entire application memory space. Basically, pin all the guest memory space into RAM, and then basically every buffers that come from the guest VM is registered, and we know that, and the RNA can access to it. But it's pretty limiting because it's, you know, all the 1 gig or 2 gig that the VM is getting is pinned into RAM space, and it's not very scalable when you want to stack VMs on the same hypervisor. Another would be to implement a pool of buffers and then modify the application to, instead of using the POSIX allocation APIs, to use the transport or the mid-layer to also supply the buffers, much like DPDK. That's the way DPDK works. But it requires modifying the applications, and we wanted to move away from that. Another method that exists in the HPC use cases is a pin-down cache. Basically, is registration and caching of registrations on the fly. Basically, you get a buffer. If it's not registered, you register it. Hopefully, if you get spatial and temporal locality, you'll find the same buffers over and over again. So in the steady state, you should be able to get enough remappings. But there are a lot of complications when you get partial overlaps, and you need to decide what to do, whether to tear down the less registration and perform a bigger new one, or just register the soft part that is not already registered. So it's not the most friendly logic, but it's doable. Yes, Idan?
So there is also a place in between, right? So you're saying when you use this caching scheme, so this pin-down cache, so you can also say that...
we don't use it, but some use it.
Yeah, when you implement that, okay? Mm-hmm. And when you implement the pin-down cache, then you can say, well, when I'm missing, when I have a miss, I don't have to register because the registration costs a lot, I can copy.
Yeah.
So copy on the
small buffers. Okay, so that's come closer to what we did. But
yeah.
Okay, so basically you can say, okay, the buffer is small enough, I'm willing to pay the overhead of data copy.
Yeah.
But if the buffer is large, then I wouldn't want to copy like 64K, so I'll register it. So that's another approach to write this on right here. But the real interesting one is pageable RDMA, which is called on-demand paging. For, I think, 2 years ago, we added this capability to the stack to support basically paging and from IO devices. Okay, so what's basically it allows applications to trust the hardware and the kernel drivers to handle page faults and just work seamlessly as if all my memory was registered while it's not very much. Okay, so basically what if the device needs to support it needs to keep a secondary translation table, which should resemble the, you know, the OS translation table, page table, and we use the device once it tries to access a page which is not present, okay, which is not mapped with the device, it can raise a page fault. The kernel driver gets that page fault, handles the page fault, basically restores the page mapping, and then tells the hardware to continue. And again, and from the other side, the OS, the operating system, can invalidate a page if it wants to swap it out or migrate it to a different NUMA socket. So we hooked into the MMU notifier callouts that are available in the MM subsystem. So basically, we get an MMU notification that this page is about to be invalidated. So we sync it with the hardware, and then say, and then once the hardware attempts to access this page, which is invalidated, it will raise a page fault, and then our driver or the kernel driver can handle it and restore it back and restore the mapping and tell it to continue. So this concept is. I didn't want to get in that deep, but okay, so it depends on your transport connection. So if it's an unreliable datagram, the incoming packet that cannot be serviced is just dropped, or it's implementation specific. The device can hold like some emergency internal buffer that can store the datagram. And let the kernel take care of the page faults and then DMA to memory, or it can drop. Okay. If it's a reliable connection, it just sends back to the peer a receive not ready non acknowledge, and then the peer should retry.
In the case of IWARP, it would be superior transmission.
Yeah. Exactly.
So the upper layer protocol has to deal with the RNR, doesn't it?
No. It's implemented in hardware. The only thing that the upper layer should know is to program the QP to give some number of retries per RNR NUX. What do you mean? You're laughing.
Well, I know that NMS have already made clients generally set RNR to zero because they have their own product.
If you will want to use if you are aware that your other side is using paging technology, then you would need to be ready to accept or get back receive not ready RNR NUX.
Yeah, the ULP has to be aware of this.
What is the purpose of setting it to zero?
That means that there's no latency. It's dropped, and we drop the connection. We figure out that we did something wrong. It's a bug.
Yeah, but it's for the debugability.
As soon as that happens, you know that something is not right in your client or server. It's for software. It's not something that happens in normal practice.
Yes. So let's assume I would call it RNR number 2. You could attribute to this qubit that RNR NUX number 2 is something that could be handled by hardware because it is being handling on-demand paging. Would you accept that? Would you think that then the ULP doesn't have to be aware of that?
The problem is there are a lot of ULP implementations out there that are reset to zero.
Well, I think that setting it to zero is—I don't know if it's correct because you don't know if the other side is using shared CPUs, for example. So if this server is serving like 100 clients and it uses shared CPU to scale in order to scale, you might get receive not ready if that server is packed and if it's not posting receive work requests in time. So it's not necessarily something that went wrong, but you can say that in my application or my implementation, it's not acceptable for me. I would like to tear down the connection and then restore it.
Fair enough.
Right.
Yes, it could be also a decision to make also on on-demand paging problem, right? So you could have a decision when I get an on-demand paging. I want to.
You don't know from the pure side. You don't know that the other side is.
Yes.
But you could theoretically resolve that, right? It's a decision that you make on the deterministic latency that you want to achieve, right?
But there's a distinction between solicited data transfer getting page fault versus unsolicited data, like shared receive queue scenario, which is different in RNR, right?
Well, yeah, there's a difference, of course, and for reliable connection, which I think all our storage ULP drivers use reliable connection, it will always result in our normal.
Sorry.
So ISO with ODB, so Okay, so now we established that the application can register like huge memory regions, which are very lightweight, nothing is allocated, okay, and none of the pages are actually pinned. It's just virtual, and once the I/O starts flowing in, the kernel will handle page faults, so you get a ramp up, and then, you know, if in the steady state, you don't see a lot of page fault. So the application or the guest can basically register the entire memory space as a single memory key, but for storage, you don't want to expose all your, you can't really send this memory key to a remote target to do RDMA because it's exposing the entire memory space of the guest. Okay, so what we need to do is basically use memory windows. Okay, so this is a technology that allows, if the application has like a very big buffer that has local permission, it can open a memory window within this memory, within this buffer, and upgrade the remote, and upgrade the permissions for remote access, and then send the R key back to the target to do RDMA. Sorry.
So what would what is
on-demand paging? So it's basically the pageability of RDMA. Okay, the capability of the device to generate page faults, which are handled by the kernel and invalidation. So basically, ICER cannot send this the entire memory space R key to a target to do RDMA because it's somewhat of a security violation. It needs to basically for each I/O get this offset and buffer of this specific transaction, open a memory window on it, which is a fast operation. We can do it in the data plane. And then send its R key to the initiator, and then to the target, and then the target will RDMA, only has permissions to access this buffer alone. Okay? So this is the plan, and this is what we intend to do. Currently, we have we don't have support for pageable memory windows, okay? So basically, once the driver sees a page fault, it needs to know it's a memory window and recover the page translations from there, and not a native memory key. So this support is still ongoing, but we have initial results, and it looks promising. And this is the way that we think that it should work, and this is the way we think it should be implemented. Hopefully other devices will embrace this technology. And actually, we think that also for NVMe technology, we also see the benefits of using page faults and not pinning the entire guest memory space for the VM to access the NVMe device. So, we have a few thoughts on this this area. Okay, summary and conclusion. So basically what we did is introduce the ISO, an alternative ISO implementation. We have the one in the kernel. We have now one in user space. We integrated the driver into QMU, which is still in the works. It's driven by Roy and Ronnie and Paolo and all these folks. We were able to get pretty good performance scaling compared to the native TCP stack and VirtIO pass-through ICER devices from the kernel. But again, the current implementation has disadvantage of memory footprint because, again, pageable RDMA is still not working with memory windows. So we can't use that at the moment. So basically what we do is we do a copy for small transfers or register large transfers. What can be done next? First of all, adding the paging support for memory windows so ICER can use it efficiently and push it into the open source Libre Tasi. We have plenty of room for performance optimizations in the I/O path. We also have stability improvements, especially error-prone paths that are not fully resilient by now. And we would like We would love to have some specific ICER unit tests in device study itself. So these are areas that if you're interested, you're welcome to contribute.
So this project was conducted under the supervision and guidance of Dr. Shlomo Greenberg from Ben Gurion University. And I want to give special thanks to Ronnie Salberg, which helped me a lot during the way to merge it inside the LibaSCSI open source, and also helped me with QMU integration of ICER. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.